How does my sinfulness show itself? It shows itself in lots and lots of ways. One of the ways that I see it daily is in my desire to rationalize, to make you wrong, to make me right, to not have to pay the cost of looking at the reality of my own sin, and to blame you instead.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Ephesians 6:10 is the beginning of what we call the spiritual warfare passage. And, Jack, it's such a kind of military-like passage. It really looks like Paul is saying, look, there's a battle out there, and you really better get ready for it. None of the men would have gone into Vietnam without being fully armed and fully ready. I bring up Vietnam because that's from my era. And it seems like we go into life thinking we're going into something that's not really very difficult, but in a sense we're going into Vietnam just by entering life all the time.
That's right.
I'm really struck by how difficult life is and how much we need to work at really standing firm in our beliefs. I've been so saddened by a number of people that I've heard about or seen in the last several months who look like they have strong beliefs, who look like they are really wanting to pursue their faith, and yet, as it turns out, when they come into difficulties in their life, when things come up against them that kind of challenge how they want to see life or how they want to see themselves in particular, it seems like they fall away. Instead of following God, they want other people to follow them. Instead of following God, they want to maintain their own cherished self-image rather than looking at the person God says they are. And in looking at these people, I have been challenged to not gossip about them, to not think that I'm in a better place than them. I've really found myself recently kind of being proud about that, and that is spiritual warfare in my life. And it's so deceptive, it's often so subtle, sometimes not subtle at all, but we really need to be armed and to stand firm in God, because the struggle in life is very, very big.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And I think that's the point of this passage, is he's ending the letter with this, and he's saying, in effect, to these Ephesians, just what you said. It's tough. It's treacherous. It's dangerous. A lot of people can lose their souls along the way. So make sure you go prepared for battle and engaged in battle. Do the battle. Fight the fight, because you could lose this one.
And you're not saying that once I have a firm belief and God has chosen me, that I have the possibility of losing my place with God, but it's life is really challenging whether or not I truly have that place with God or not.
Right. Yeah, it's true that if God has chosen us, we are secure in the eternal plans of God. But we are not secure in spite of what we do, or in spite of what we choose, or in spite of what decisions we might make. We are secure because we are going to make the right decisions. God is going to guarantee that. God, who's the author of my being and my salvation, is going to take me through the course, and I'm going to win the race. I'm going to win the battle. But that doesn't change the fact, that's the tension in the New Testament, that doesn't change the fact that there is a battle to be fought and I must fight it victoriously. So, you know, I can't just passively sit back and say, oh, well, if God's going to take care of it, I don't need to worry about it. I do need to worry about it, and I am going to win. I am going to succeed. That's the guarantee, because God is going to author that kind of victory in my life. There's no reason, there's no excuse for us taking life passively just because God has promised the outcome. It's not that kind of promise.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's that kind of promise at all, or Paul wouldn't have written this Ephesians passage where he says, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil." I mean, the language is quite strong.
Right.
That there's going to be a lot of battles out there. There's going to be a lot of issues that come your way. And you really, really, really better know that and be prepared for that, because it's a tough life.
Right.
In trying to look more closely at spiritual warfare, what we have been doing in the last several weeks is look at the people and their struggle in the spiritual warfare that they encountered in Jesus' trial and eventual death on the cross. There's a lot of people who failed the test. One was Herod, one was Pontius Pilate, and I think today we were looking at the chief priests.
Actually, what we can do is look at both the chief priests and Pilate. I think both of them are alike in this regard, in the extent to which, well, it's not that we see any evidence in the text, but any kind of moral impurity that you see in both Pilate and the chief priests is typically accompanied by rationalization. And I thought we would look at the dynamic of rationalization in the spiritual warfare that we encounter.
Okay, kind of put those two together and
help
people understand what in the world you're talking about when you say rationalization and spiritual warfare. How do they go together?
Yeah, I think all of us can look at our lives and look at our moral failures, and if we're honest with ourselves, we see clearly how we do something very self-serving, that is clearly self-serving, that is just patently self-serving on the one hand, and yet we convince ourselves that we are doing something that is either right because it's in somebody else's best interests, or at least somehow excusable.
I can give you a great example.
Okay.
Last night I was talking to some people who were telling me about somebody who's really kind of walked away from the faith or fallen away from the faith pretty significantly. And through another friend, I know some information about them that would have helped these other people. And it would have helped them in their understanding of what happened to this person. And I really wanted to gossip. And I was saying to myself, well, it's okay to say this about this person, because it would help my other friends understand better and help them be more firm in their belief of what's going on with this situation. But it would have simply been gossip. It would have been wrong. If they should have that information, if they should have it, it should not come from me. It's not mine to give.
Mm-hmm.
And do you see? So I rationalized it. It was okay.
Yes.
But it's not okay.
Right.
And I should say, I didn't do it. But that's the warfare, is I really wanted to.
Right.
That's the battle, which comes down to a lot of choices. Am I going to choose to do the right thing? Am I going to choose to do the wrong thing? When there's a lot of weight, a lot of push, a lot of water behind me saying, yeah, go ahead and do that. It's okay.
Right. And I think that's involved in what Paul calls in that passage we've been looking at in Ephesians 6, the schemes of the devil. That oftentimes he packages the suggestions that we do the wrong thing in the form of, but it will be a good thing. It will be the right thing. Or, as I said, at the very least, but who can blame you? For one reason or another, we find a way to take the burden of responsibility off of my evil and onto something else. So who would blame you? It's excusable that you do this.
And my guess is, Jack, in a lot of situations, most people would say, I won't blame you. You know, I can see how you did it, and oh well. But I think it comes down to God, who has a much higher standard than us,
right,
who's saying, let's stand up for moral purity and not make any allowances for ourselves.
Right. Let me use a couple of just big examples that we see in literature and movies and in our media. Take the way in which adultery is often defended or excused. It is in my wife's best interest that I carry on this affair. I love my wife. I'm committed to her. I don't love my lover. It's just that they meet some needs that I have that my wife can't possibly meet. So I'm making myself a better husband to my wife by having this affair.
Now, Jack,
something along those lines.
When you say that, that's so foreign to me. It's
really
hard for me to think somebody would rationalize that way, but I guess so.
But don't you hear it in, like, in the movies and the media, our culture? I've heard it in a lot of different places. Yeah, I mean, it sounds very strange. From the outside, it seems just ridiculous. And yet, you have an attempt made to portray that sympathetically in many, many movies, that kind of thing, song lyrics.
I guess that's why I don't watch much TV and I don't look at many movies, because I'm always so disappointed in the message that they give.
Yeah, well, right, absolutely. Another one is abortion. I don't think I can do a good enough job as a mother to this child. I don't want this child. I'm not really into this mothering task here in this situation. It would be better if this child had never been conceived. I can do that. I'll make it as if this child had never been conceived. That's all I'm doing.
Or another rationalization that I hear a lot, particularly from Christian women, is it would put my parents through so much pain. It would be such a bad testimony to our church or to the people that are not believers. And so I'm just going to abort this child. Well, they say this fetus. I think another one is they make it not a child. They make it not a person, but make it a fetus, a non-thing.
Right. Well, those are fairly dramatic examples, but that's just the normal operating procedure of temptation, of Satan, the schemes of the devil. It's what we face in the battle of spiritual warfare, is that we are so ready with our rationalizations to make evil look good or at least excusable. And then we succumb and choose the evil and do the evil, thinking that we have, you know, adequately accommodated morality in our choice. So we walk away thinking that we have done no wrong, when that's exactly what we've done. We've done something that's perverse and evil.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. That's the rationalization, is we convince ourselves by whatever arguments we need to have the outcome that we want, rather than looking at what is the standard of God.
Right.
And Jackie used some pretty big examples, those of adultery and abortion. But as I mentioned earlier, these fiery darts of the devil come from very subtle corners of our lives also. I think I could be someone listening to this program and think, wow, you know, I'm pretty clean. I haven't done those things. But I think it has really been helpful to me to not look at the big things in my life, because I haven't made those kind of huge, enormous mistakes. I didn't commit adultery. I haven't murdered somebody. I don't steal. I haven't had an abortion. And yet, it has been so important for me to look at how I have a heart that really wants to go against what's right. And I think that's really an important task of each believer, is to say, how in my life am I falling short of the standard of God, rather than measuring it against somebody who's in jail or somebody who's done the obvious sins, but look at the more subtleties of my own life.
Right.
In fact, I was talking to somebody who listens to this program a few days ago, and they said, and they had done something really wrong, and they were just so ashamed to be talking to me. And I said, wow, I'm made of the same stuff that you are. My sins are not as visible as yours are, but mine certainly are there. And she said to me, you know, I just can't believe that. I hear you and I hear Jack on the radio, and I just don't think that you have even thought the same awful thoughts that I have. And that really grieves me. And I'd like to just put it on the record that I have a sense of myself as being just as hurtful and just as in need of the cross as Barabbas was.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it's actually a prerequisite for our salvation, ultimately, to have that kind of perception of ourselves and to recognize the truth that that's who we are and that's where we are.
You were going to give some examples of yourself, and I think I interrupted you.
Two things that come to mind immediately where I constantly face this is that if I get caught off guard making some kind of mistake, so there being some inadequacy in my knowledge or my, you know, I misremember something or so on, and there's a temptation to be defensive, and I might respond defensively. It's interesting how often that's accompanied by this little voice of rationalization going on that is either saying one of two things. Either, well, it really wasn't actually a mistake after all, and in effect, that's why your defensiveness is justified, because you didn't really make a mistake after all. And it's really kind of almost comical, because I'm working so hard at it because it's obvious to me as well as everybody else that it was a mistake. Why would I?
Why do you have to work so hard if it's?
Yeah, I mean, why defend yourself so against something that's so obviously true to you? But that's the diabolical nature of rationalization: is that it is just so absolutely stubborn and persistent. I don't want to be wrong. I don't want to see myself as wrong. I don't want to see myself as in any way inadequate. And
or have anybody else see me that way.
Yeah, well, especially have other people see me that way. So I know that my defensiveness is inappropriate, but I'm working overtime to try to justify and excuse my defensiveness. I made a mistake and I got defensive about it, and here's this voice over here saying, well, it wasn't really a mistake, and so, you know, it's appropriate that you that you defend yourself here. And normally I can see through it, and it's just so obvious, and it's still a very active force in me. The other one is being inconvenienced in any way. We are so self-centered. I am so self-centered that I would rather not have to do what I don't want to do. I don't want love to be a kind of bondage that forces me to serve other people. And that kind of miffed reaction that you experience, that you feel when you feel put upon by someone, someone's needs, someone's problems are encroaching on your life, and now all of a sudden love is demanding that you meet them, and I get irritated, or I don't even know how to describe it, but that put out feeling and that put out behavior. And I engage in put-out behavior. I see this especially with my children.
You engage in put-out behavior.
Uh-huh.
You become kind of like a jerk.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. And again, that voice comes up that says, well, it's not really your fault. It's their fault.
I have a great example. You were 20 minutes late, inconveniencing both Jennifer and I this morning before the radio program. And we were sitting up talking to my son. And he had not done the dishes. That's his job this week. And I was nanny, 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 grumping at him. And he was kind of coming back at me. And I thought, well, I'm justified because I've told him a million billion times to get these dishes done. So it's okay that I'm kind of a little bit on edge here because he didn't do his job. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And if you hadn't been 20 minutes late, Jack, I wouldn't have been up there nanny, 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 being like that at my son.
Right.
So
it's my fault.
It's your fault.
Exactly.
That's kind of the way we go, isn't it?
Uh-huh, exactly. And it comes back to the point that you made earlier. That is so, so normal, such natural human behavior that we even hesitate to call it wrong. I mean, we're inclined to say if we took an opinion poll, we probably would come out looking pretty good. We'd have a, 55% approval rating or something like that.
Or more.
Or more. But as you pointed out, but unfortunately, it's not a public opinion poll that's going to be our judge. It's a God who is asking a higher level of purity than that. And that's the standard by which we need to judge ourselves. We need to recognize that no matter how justified I might be in seeing the wrong in my child, seeing that my child is being selfish, irresponsible, or whatever, that doesn't justify my reacting and behaving in a rude, sarcastic, unloving, unkind way.
That's exactly the point, too. I think lots of times we look at other people's behavior and we can say, I'm justified because look what they did. And lots of times I am justified or it is right for me to say something about it. But as my husband so often says to me, Christine, it's not what you're saying to me, but it's how you're saying it. I just hate it when he tells me that. I want to justify it all over the place because what I have to tell him is so right on. I mean, even telling my son this morning that he didn't do the dishes and he should have done the dishes and could have done the dishes and could have gotten up earlier. It was, it was right. He really should. But the way I did it was inappropriate. And you know what the rascal did? He said, I didn't know it was my dishes. And I said, yeah, you did. You knew it was your dishes this morning. And you know what? He just kind of backed down and went, yeah, you're right. Took the air out of my sails because he wasn't justifying anymore. He just kind of copped to it. Oh, he outclasses his mother all the time.
Don't you hate it when you're doing this rationalization dance and the other one doesn't participate?
Oh, yeah. Kind of puts all the blame on me. It kind of heaps the guilt where it should go, right on me.
I've used this example before in another context, but it illustrates. I mean, it was such an epiphany for me. It was such a glimpse through the window into the insides of my soul that it was a very significant event for me. I think I've described this experience in a freshman seminar where I just did a treacherous act where I had been giving an answer to the professor's question, and one of my dorm mates, who was also in the seminar, understood what I was saying, and when the professor couldn't understand what I was saying, he took up defending my position. And as he said so, it was clear to me that he understood what I was saying, and I was cheering him on, all kinds of nonverbal language, yes, yes, yeah, you got it, that's it. At which point the professor turned to him and said, "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life," and totally embarrassed him. I mean, it was awful. I mean, on the part of the professor, I've never seen anything quite so cruel as what he did.
Just cut him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, cut him in half. It was terrible. Well, you know, it was kind of like a blow to the stomach. He didn't say anything. All he could do is kind of look at me and gesture toward me, beseeching me to join him in his misery, and said, "Well, that's what Jack was saying." And the professor turned to me and said, "Is that what you were saying, Jack?" And, you know, the courageous thing at that point to do would have been, obviously, to tell the truth as well as the right thing to do. And I really punted, and I said, "Oh, well, I'm not sure," which was just a flat-out lie. He had nailed what I was saying exactly, and I knew that. But I basically lied to spare myself joining him in his embarrassment. That was bad enough. But the other glimpse into my soul was, I still remember walking back to the dorm room, telling myself over and over again, as if to brainwash myself, "Well, you really weren't sure that he was saying exactly the same thing that you were saying, Jack."
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So you added insult to injury.
Right. I was telling that to myself. That's how resistant we are to just admitting the awful truth about ourselves, that we are evil. And I wasn't going to go there. I wasn't going to allow myself to think that I was a coward and a liar. What I wanted to tell myself is, there's a good reason why you answered the professor the way you did. Don't blame yourself. Don't kick yourself over that, Jack. There's a good reason why you said what you did. There was enough doubt, enough uncertainty, that you were perfectly justified to answer the way you were. Well, I didn't believe that for a second. It was clear as day what I had done. I had been a coward. I had been a liar. I had been cruel. I had been treacherous. I had betrayed him. I mean, there was nothing good about what I had done. It was awful. And it wasn't until years later, reflecting on it, I mean, my rationalization was so entrenched and so strong that I never really convinced myself that I hadn't done anything wrong, but I was able to kind of keep it at arm's length. That's sort of what I was doing. I kept it out there where I didn't have to really look at it and own it and ask myself, "Well, what are you going to do about the fact that you've been such a coward, a liar, and an evil person?" I could just keep going, keep trudging along in life, keep coasting, and not face that question directly, which is usually all we can really accomplish with rationalization. But it wasn't until years later, when I finally had kind of faced that question more directly and survived, acknowledging that I was a sinner, that I began to think, reflect back on that event, and it really became a significant symbol for me in my own life of what this is all about and how evil operates in our lives.
Yeah, you've brought that example up a number of times here, and I think it's because it really must be pivotal in your life. You saw your heart very clearly and the hurtfulness of it and just couldn't deny it, couldn't walk away from it. And I think you've told us before that you never had that friendship again.
Right.
So that must have really cemented that in your mind, too. You couldn't justify it as well. If he had just said, "Oh, that's okay, no big deal," it might have been easier for you to walk away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I even tried to restore the relationship, but he was just too wounded, too hurt, and I couldn't get through any longer. And, you know, I don't blame him. I mean, I don't blame him for that at all. It's, you couldn't do a greater act of betrayal, I don't imagine, than what I did. I mean, it's not like he died because of it, but he might as well have. That's how treacherous my betrayal was.
Well, and let's put it in context. You were at Stanford University, which is the center of intellectualism. There probably isn't a student, or very many students, for sure, that go there whose intellect isn't quite important to them.
Yeah.
And that professor was cutting right at the very core of what would have been his identity.
Yeah, exactly.
And you could have gone to another school or another place where maybe somebody who was really interested in athletics, and the professor would have said, or the coach would have said, you are just a loser as an athlete, why don't you quit? Mm-hmm. That would have cut him as badly. But I think we got to look at this in context, because somebody could say, no big deal. It's a huge deal, because that's what defined him.
Right. I think all the time that I was there, the suicide rate at Stanford was greater than any other university in the country. Just the pressure to make the cut intellectually was so great on people that it was devastating.
Jack, in the midst of talking about this situation, you made a very interesting comment that I want to pull out here for a minute. You said, once I was able to survive looking at the evil in my heart, then I could look back at the situation and say, okay, I really was cruel. It really was terrible what I did. What do you mean, once I was able to survive looking at what was inside of me? Why use the word survive?
Well, I'm not sure, except that I think about the experience of how desperately I was trying to avoid that, there was something in me, and ultimately now I recognize it was part of my rebellion against God. It was part of the sinner that I am, that just is so frantically trying to avoid seeing the truth about myself. I mean, it acts like a kind of fear, is what it acts like.
Well, Jack, I don't think it's a kind of fear. I think it's the deepest of human fears.
Yeah, probably so.
It is the core of human fear.
Yeah.
That I really don't want to look at myself. And I was asking a question that obviously I was interested. Because it seems like when we meet up with the person that we are, we have to shed a lot of things that we wished we were, or that we've tried to communicate to other people that we are, or tried to believe about ourselves, or that has kept us insulated from pain in our lives. And sometimes it feels like, in facing those things, that we really will not survive.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like life or death.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of what Jesus was trying to capture in all those statements that he makes about, in order to live, you must die. You know, a grain of seed cannot live until it goes into the ground and dies, and then it brings forth life. A number of occasions he makes comments like that, and I think that's exactly right. We have to shed the person of my own manufacture in order to become living as the person that God created me to be. And it does feel like suicide. It feels like I'm killing the person that I am. And in a sense, we are.
Well, we are, because we don't really know what's going to be on the other side or what's going to be left over. My big identity was based on being pretty together. And slowly over the years, painfully, that has been taken away. But I really didn't know what was on the other side, because on this side of being together, there's some prestige. There's some place in people's eyes. There's some status. And if I give that up, then how do I live without status, without prestige, without people acknowledging how great I am? And at the other side of it, I get it. It's peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. It feels calmer. It's not such a race in life.
Life doesn't feel quite so precarious and fragile, as if it's going to fall apart if you don't put the energy into it.
Yeah, and I don't have to run so fast.
Yeah,
I don't have to run so hard. I don't have to be so much to so many people. I just get to live before God. It's a surprising turn. I really didn't expect more freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I expected only loss. Mm-hmm. The process of getting to the freedom is loss. Is grief, and having to embrace that is really an important part of the process. But I'm really thankful for being on this other side and look forward to more of it.
Yeah.
Because I think life presents us with a lifelong task of having to shed what we'd like to think about ourselves and see ourselves as God sees us.
I don't know quite what to make of this, but I read a really interesting thing this week that it just struck me. World Magazine had an article on contemporary Christian music and kind of what's going on there and the dynamics involved in that industry, that niche market in music. And there was a quote in there by Michael Card, I believe it was, and I don't know his work. A friend of mine really likes his stuff a lot. It's some of the deeper, more substantial stuff that's happening in contemporary Christian music, evidently. But I don't know whether it was in an interview that he did or in the lyrics of some song, but there was some part of what he was presenting to the public was going to talk about his struggle with suicide at some point in his life. And this record producer told him, "We can't let that out. We can't let the public know that you have had these struggles with suicide because," and then I don't remember exactly, but the basic idea is you have to have a certain image that you need to fit in order for people to respect you, to look up to you, to honor you, and so on and so forth.
To want to buy your music and make a lot of money.
Exactly. And in the end, it was to buy music and make money. But along the lines of what you're saying, we get all kinds of reinforcement by our culture, by the Christian culture, by the church. Everywhere we turn, we get all kinds of reinforcement to put up a front, a facade, to pretend to be one way, rather than just look at the raw, bare truth about myself and tell it exactly like it is and let it be known exactly as it is. It's not just my own internal struggle. I have all kinds of an audience cheering me on to play the game, to be dishonest. So you put the two together, my natural tendency to go that direction anyway, and then all kinds of support to do that, and it takes a tremendous amount of courage and integrity to just not rationalize, not lie, not hide, but face into who I am for who I am and speak honestly about that.
And be willing to lose a lot of what I think about myself and possibly have the willingness to lose the admiration of other people.
Yeah.
And friendships, maybe a job. There's a lot that can be lost when we don't meet up to the expectations of other people.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the passage. We were trying to look at the rationalization of the chief priests.
Well, we don't know exactly what the rationalizations were, except for one, and that is of the chief priests, and that is, we don't see it in all the passages, but there's one gospel that talks about the high priest standing up and saying it's better that one man should die for the nation than that the whole nation should perish. And he comments on that in the context of saying that this Jesus is going to stir up the crowds and cause riots, and Roma's going to come in and they're going to take away our position and our place. So the chief priest's concern was for their own status, for their wealth, for their name, for their honor, their position of power and authority and so on. It was very self-serving. But of course, he turns around immediately and casts it in terms of the whole nation would suffer at the hands of Rome if we allow this man Jesus to go around causing trouble. We need to get rid of him because it'll be in the whole nation's best interest. So they take something that's self-serving and turn it and make it sound like it's in the interest of the whole, and therefore we are going to serve the whole by doing that. That's not in the context of the trial. That happens earlier in the Gospels, but that's where we get a glimpse of the nature of their rationalization. So it fits into that category that we talked about earlier of taking something that's really basically clearly, manifestly self-serving and evil, and yet casting it in a light that makes it seem like it's a good thing that I'm doing. It's in other people's best interest that we do this. That's just rationalization. Pilate had a different kind of rationalization. Pilate was convinced right up to the end that he really had no reason to execute this man Jesus. He was not a threat. He was not a threat to Rome. He was basically innocuous from Pilate's perspective. He was somewhat intrigued by Jesus. And so he didn't he didn't really see any reason why he should execute him, and he was, you know, frankly, a little bit irritated with the chief priests that they were putting him in that position.
And it says that he made efforts to release them.
Right, yeah. And he repeatedly made efforts to release him, if you put the chronology all together, I think. So he really, to the bitter end, was trying to make a political compromise with people and just somehow get this guy released. And what's interesting is, Pilate appears to be basically a fairly ruthless and brutal man. I mean, killing somebody is not a big deal to him. So the fact that he would go so far to try to get Jesus released is pretty significant, because it's not like it was out of any kind of decency or compassion or any sort of humanitarian concern. I think he just realized, look, this is just ridiculously unjust, and it's not in my best interest to be unjust in this situation. He'd be ready to be unjust if he had anything to gain by it, I think. But he didn't have anything to gain by it, and it was just wrong, so why should he do it?
He was kind of, it seems to me through the Gospels, he's kind of saying, I don't get it, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I kill this guy? He seems innocent. He seems like an okay guy. He's saying some things that make sense to me. How come? But Jack, didn't he have the authority to not put...
Yes. Yeah. There's no way in the world that he had to put him to death.
He was just giving in to the pressure of the crowd.
The pressure of the crowd, and what seemed to be the clincher, is the high priest come to Pilate in the end and they say, off the top of my head, I don't remember how they phrased it exactly, but in effect they said, well, maybe we'll have to go talk to Caesar about this. Well, Pilate's well aware what the dangers are when anybody appeals to Caesar or complains to Caesar, because he's known in the recent history, every time an emissary has been sent to Caesar to complain about the ruler in Palestine, that ruler has been replaced.
Well, this is what it says. If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar.
Okay.
Boy, they're really using a strong card.
Right.
Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. So, boy, they're really pulling out their trump card, aren't they?
Yeah, they're saying Caesar's going to be threatened by what we say about Jesus, and you'll see then. Pilate recognizes now that they will probably follow through on their threat and he will lose his job. Now, all of a sudden, it's clearly a case of he has something to lose by not putting Jesus to death. So he capitulates and he says, okay, I'll do it. But not without going before the crowd, symbolically washing his hands and saying, I refuse to have his blood on my hands, in effect. I'm not guilty of this. You're guilty. And in a very chilling kind of moment in that whole drama, the crowd yells out, let his blood be upon our heads and upon the heads of our children, something like that, something to that effect. So the rationalization that Pilate is using, I think, that is his rationalization, the washing of his hands. He has the authority. If he had had the courage, if he had had the love of justice that he should have had, if he had had the love of doing what's right and what's good that he should have had, then against their threats, he should have had the courage to just say, I'm the governor here. I have been commissioned by Caesar to make this decision. I don't find any fault in this man. I'm not going to execute him, period. You do what you want to do. You do what you have to do. My job is to bring about justice. I'm not going to kill him. And he had all the authority in the world to do that. But what he decided to do instead is, I will go ahead and kill him, but I'm going to say it's your fault and not my fault. You're to blame, not me. That's another classic ploy in rationalization, is blame shifting. Yes, okay, it's wrong to do it, but it's not my evil that made me do the wrong. It's your evil that made me do the wrong. And we do that all the time.
I'm thinking of the classic example, that of divorce. And I hear a lot of people say, you know, this marriage wouldn't be ending if so-and-so had not done this or that. It really isn't my responsibility. It is theirs. And they can usually pick a larger, obvious sin. And that's what I think we do a lot to justify or rationalize what we're doing, is I put the spotlight on the person who's had the affair, and I don't look at myself who has been a liar. I put the spotlight on the person who has had an affair again, and I don't look at how demanding and hurtful I have been. I put my focus on the person who's having an affair, and I don't look at the stubbornness and selfishness and unwillingness to contribute to the relationship. I put the focus on the other person and justify it and say, it's okay that I should leave. After all, you did this or that.
Yeah, yeah. Not really trying to redefine the wrongness of what is happening. Okay, it's wrong, but the blame doesn't land on me. It's not my evil that has brought about this wrong. It's the other person's evil that's brought it about.
Rather than sharing it. And I think that's exactly what was happening here with the chief priest and with Pontius Pilate. They were both to blame. They both had their own selfish justification for what they were doing. Neither of them were really willing to look at it at all. I think that's what happens in life a lot. I don't want to look at where I went wrong. I want to see where you're wrong. You don't want to look at where you're wrong. You see where I'm wrong. I really see that with my kids a lot. They go round and around and around in a circle and say, who else was wrong? And I think I've said in the radio program before, I haul them all into a room together and I say, okay, I did this last Friday night. I was outside talking to a friend who was helping paint our garage door, and I hear this really loud noise happening inside our house, and the kids are all upset with each other. So I walk into the house. Mind you, my kids, one of them, the kid, is 19, pretty old, and he was in the middle of it. And so I haul them all into the family room and say, okay, everybody sit down. Now, what I want you to do is tell me what you did wrong. So I don't want to, you know,
Mom,
I don't want you to,
fair.
Yeah, I know. I don't want you to say what he did or he to say what she did. I just want you to kind of give me a rundown of what you did. And it's like one of my kids said, I'm not participating. I said, okay, that's fine, but you don't get your car this weekend. Oh. So it's very difficult. I mean, and one of my children said, this doesn't get anywhere. We go along around the same place all the time, over and over again. This never gets better. She never stops doing this or that. And I said, you know, you're right. And I can't make her stop what she's doing, and I can't make you stop what you're doing. But what I can do is help face you into the reality of what you've done, to take responsibility at least for your role. And so I'm teaching you something that's really helpful in dealing with conflict. You don't shift the blame. You don't rationalize it. You don't justify it. You take it on and you look where you're wrong and you admit it. And I think that's about as far as we can go in parenting in a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
And I wish I would have known that 10 years ago, that it doesn't matter if we end up solving this problem. I would dearly love to, believe me, Jack. But I don't think it's going to be solved until they grow up and they're less selfish. But I really can, through their conflicts, help them look at their own responsibility over and over and over again, so that they at least have the concept of, I have a responsibility. This really isn't justified. I really had my part. And so shifting blame will be more uncomfortable and more difficult for them, and maybe they'll catch themselves later on in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good parenting strategy, huh?
It is. Sounds good to me. And there's nothing automatic about getting older and learning that. I mean, we really have to work at it.
I think we really have to have it pointed out to us.
Have it pointed out.
Because it really does look like I'm not the problem. It really does look like it's their sister or their brother that caused the problem. It's not me. I mean, how could I help but throw the notebook across the room because she was doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm justified.
Yeah, we get more subtle, smoother, classier, more sophisticated in the way we behave and justify our behavior and so on. We're not as clumsy as children can be at that, but it's the same problem
mm-hmm.
when we get older.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't face into it and confront the fear of seeing ourselves the way we really are, if we don't die to ourselves, like Jesus said, then we cannot really live. So it's an absolutely crucial reality that we have to face into if we're going to grow at all.
Well, the question that I often ask myself is, what part did I play in this? What was my role here? And that's really helpful to me because I don't want to look at my role. I don't want to see where I was wrong. And usually it takes a lot of arm twisting on my own part toward myself to finally say, okay, this was it. It doesn't matter what so-and-so did. they need to work that out before God, or if they're going to work it out with me, that's fine. But what role did I play here? And more often than not, if there's a skirmish between two people, we both played a part. Mm-hmm. One might be more noisy. One might be more obvious, but we both played a part.
Yeah.
Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, no, I think that's inevitable, because that's part of what the Bible is teaching us, is that we are all evil. We are all broken. And just because I can't see my own evil doesn't mean it's not there. It's very visible to other people when it's invisible to me. And it's visible to other people, and it's creating problems. It's creating conflicts. It's creating tension in those relationships. And I may be totally oblivious to it, but it's there. So to defend myself against the charge is pretty fruitless and pretty naive.
So, Jack, we have about 2 minutes left. Would you be willing to summarize what we've said and kind of put it all together?
Well, basically what we are trying to focus on is the role that rationalization plays in our moral impurity and in our evil, and how inevitably rationalization will accompany the temptation to do evil. There will be, along with that temptation, a ready-made defense of why it's not out of my evil that this evil is coming. It can consist of shifting the blame to someone else, or it can shift of this magic transformation of finding a way of looking at what I'm doing that is clearly evil, that allows me to look at it and say, it's actually good instead. It's actually good for somebody else. And the real reason I'm doing it is out of the goodness of my heart, not out of any evil in me. And there are
excusable, and who could blame me?
Exactly, yeah. And there are many different forms that can take, and we just need to become discerning and wise and savvy about how our mind works, how our heart deceives us in that regard. Learn to recognize rationalization when it's there, and then muster the courage to just call the lie a lie, and out of courage face into the reality of my own evil instead. And just acknowledge, you know, where this is coming from is my own evil, self-serving, perverse interests, and it's who I am, and I hate it, and I repudiate it. God save me.
Don't go away. Jack and Christine will continue the discussion in just a moment. You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare, where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help, and you get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program. Here again are Jack and Christine.
We're kind of taking a break in the middle of the program now to talk about the financial needs of Christianity at work. So, Jack, you've been on financial support for how many years in your life?
20 years, almost 20 years now.
Wow. You had to stop and think about that.
Yeah.
That's a really long time.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe it's too long now that you think of it.
Yeah.
I think that if I was on financial support for 20 years, I might feel a little bit worn down on the seams. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, I mostly don't think about it. God has been so faithful and has seen us through many a crisis. And I kind of am at a point now where I don't consider my financial situation really any more vulnerable than anybody's paycheck. I mean, anything could happen to anybody, and I'm really not in any different kind of situation. The only difference between me and the typical worker for a wage is that I know how vulnerable my financial situation is. I mean, I'm faced with that monthly. If the money isn't given out of the generosity of my supporters' hearts, then it ain't going to be there. And I'm very keenly aware of that. But God has been so faithful over the years that we haven't got rich, but we haven't gone without. So there's a tremendous amount of security in what God has shown to be his commitment to us.
So, and I guess in answer to my question, are you kind of worn out? Your answer is no.
Well, I guess not, yeah.
You're not sitting on the edge of your seat.
There are times where I literally don't know if I'm going to have an adequate paycheck the next month, where the thought crosses my mind, why do you do this? Why don't you just go out and get a job? But I believe in what I'm doing, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
And how do you apply that to Christianity at work?
How do I apply...
Just your whole perspective of finances and the ongoing program.
What carries over is that I wouldn't want anybody to think that supporting me, or in this case our program, is their responsibility. I've always taken the attitude, I don't know if I've always taken this attitude, but as I've studied the New Testament, what I've learned is I have to assume responsibility for the financial well-being of myself and my family. So I would take the same attitude toward this program, is that we don't want to twist people's arms and say, you know, you're a bad Christian if you don't support Christianity at work. That I really don't believe that. I think people can benefit greatly from this program and have different commitments and make contributions to other places. The issue biblically is just the generosity of spirit, not are you supporting our program. But we would hope that people would see enough value in what we're doing here that they would want to invest in this project by giving us money to buy the airtime.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.